Chapter 43. One night before the Emperor's murder. Harrow thrashed on the mattress and breathed in lungfuls of splintering air. She writhed like a shot animal, arms pinned her down. "Stay with us, Ninth, come on," someone was saying, and a sudden spasm seized her, shaking her from the inside until she was certain she would vibrate out of her skin. There was a susurrus of hushed mutters coming from above her, urgent voices, none of which made sense to her. "Are we stable?" "I hope so. Another pull like that and she'll bring the children back wholesale, and I don't think I can bear sending them out again. Why now? Wasn't that... I honestly preferred some of those to..." "No. Better the rules we have," interrupted the second voice. "We have no idea of the limitations in those other scenarios." Another breath, and her throat refused, closing up in protest. She turned her head and coughed, affronted, affrighted. She opened her eyes, and the world rushed up to meet her. She awoke, convinced that she was staring up at Dominicus framed within a blue sky, a lambent and unreal blue, a nonsensical backdrop. A familiar voice, Magnus's, said kindly, "You're fine, you're fine." The sky was the ceiling, and the ceiling was a decrepit room in Canaan House, veiled with the hot white breath from her own throat. When the world finally landed its long, wound-up sucker punch, a tangled howl came out of her throat, and she was shocked that she was able to make such a noise. Memory hit Harrowhark Nona Jessimus with the inexorable gravity of a satellite sucked from orbit, flinging itself to die on the surface of its bounden planet. The world hit her like a fool. There was a blur of faces, of movement. Harrow found that she was not shocked, after all. She was consumed. She was the kindling for the arson taking place in her heart, her brain dry wadding for the flames, her soul so much incandescent gas. She could not do this. She absolutely and fundamentally could not do this. "Harrow," said someone close by, someone familiar. Her vision swam. "If I forget you, let my right hand be forgotten," her mouth was saying. "Add more also if aught but death part me and thee." And, unsteadily, "Griddle." The hands must have withdrawn. She found herself face down on the mattress, sobbing as she had not sobbed since she was a child. Somebody said, "Everybody out, go." But this was more than she could take stock of. Harrow was too amazed by her body's expanding capacity for despair. It was as though her feeling doubled even as she looked at it, unfolding like falling down an endless flight of stairs. She dug her hands into the mattress and she cried for Gideon Nav. She only stopped weeping when her body had physically exhausted itself. The tears could not flow from gummed-up eyes, nor sobs from a cracked throat. For a long time she pressed her face into the wet patch of mattress she had cried into and smelled the old stuffing and felt the grief that had multiplied into a universe. She sat up. She breathed. She pressed her face into the front of her worn black robes and dried her tears into chilly tracks on her cheeks. Harrowhark looked around her, and the bloody rawness of her throat made her guttural as she asked curtly, "What have I done?" "That was actually a question I'd hoped you'd answer," said Abigail Pent. She was the only one left in the room. Harrow looked her over with new eyes. Even with this new perspective, in all respects, Pent was the same as ever. Neat, if a little scuffed around the edges, as though she really had been slumming in an ice-cold Canaan House and had not had a proper bath in a while. Brown-eyed and fresh-faced, every inch a daughter of the Fifth. There was a scarf tied around that immaculate hair, and she wore large puffy mittens on each hand. She was not, more to the point, the ruptured corpse she and Gideon had found at the bottom of the facility stairs, the body with the slit abdomen, with a key sealed neatly inside her kidney. She seemed alive, and well, and living. "You died," said Harrowhark. "Septimus killed you. The lictor masquerading as Septimus." "Yes," said the fifth adept. "It was unpleasant. Look, I hate to ask, but did you get her? None of us are sure." "Nav and I drove a sword through her breastbone," said Harrow, and swallowed against a wad of saliva burning in her throat. Her brain was whirring like an overheated mechanism. She could almost smell the hot dust. It was long past the hour to put herself in order. She said, "Give me a minute." "Take your time," said Pent. The cold did not worry Harrow until, as habit, she tried to warm her core from within and found that she could not. She was somehow not a lictor here. Pushing her blood cells around made her feel that old hungry pang for Thanagy that she had not felt for the better part of a year. She closed her eyes so that the only senses assaulting her were the temperature, the reddening burn on her cheeks and hands, and the blackness of her lids, as blank as the pages of an unwritten book. 60 seconds. Anything more was indulgence. She opened her eyes and said, "Lady Pent, tell me about your childhood bedroom." "It was the size of this sitting room, perhaps," said Pent promptly. "Two beds, with their heads against the far wall from the door. I liked to have my younger brother sleep in my room sometimes, when I was small. Primrose walls in paste-on flimsy, not wash. A pretty chroma of the Prince Undying, but a little cockeyed. A Vitti panel in place of a window, with a repeated design on it. My grandfather's arm bones over the door. A little reinforced table where I played at dolls or read, with a cubby beneath it where I was meant to crouch in case a zonal jet made it past the winnow. Phosphorescent stars painted on the ceiling, a peg on the wall for my gloves and robe. I haven't thought of it in years. Why?" "Initial test," said Harrowhark. "The flexibility of metaphysical solipsism aside, I have hardly any knowledge of the fifth house and how its people live there. The more nonsensical your answer, the more likely you were to be a construction of my brain." Abigail laughed, but it carried a tinge of rue, the laugh of a woman who had opened a long-lost book to find the most necessary page torn out. "Reverend daughter," she said, "I've been accused of many things, but this is the first time I've been assumed to be a delusion." "But you are a ghost," said the woman smilingly. "A revenant, more precisely." Then she said, "There was so much I wanted to ask, so much I'd assumed. I sought a deliberate pattern in your choices when perhaps none existed, which is a shameful mistake for a scholar. Therefore, let us debunk all my pet ideas. You are a lictor now, aren't you?" "Yes," said Harrow. "Gideon. Blood. A broken rail. It was not my intention at the end, but yes." Abigail's eyes grew intent. She leant forward. "That's one bet won," she said with grim satisfaction. "All right. When did you become aware of what was happening to you? When did you realize what was going on with the other soul?" It was easier to answer questions mechanically. "In the first days, I knew she would be absorbed. I understood that I would inadvertently destroy her soul. The process was already underway. But it hadn't finished. I had time. I decided to remove my ability to so incorporate her, by removing my ability to comprehend her." Easier now to recall it. A litany. The same sing-song recitation as the eightfold word. It could almost live apart from suffering. "I took the part of my brain that remembered her, that understood her soul, and I disconnected it. Then I made rather crude systems so as not to be accidentally reminded, knowing that the pathways might reopen if they were knocked about. I had an accomplice, someone who knew how to manipulate the fatty tissue of the brain better than I possibly could. I made my skull a construct, programmed to apply pressure to specific lobes. And it worked, Pent. It worked, she said. It was stupid, a brute force solution, but it worked. Abigail was looking at her very carefully, with a different expression than before. Haro knew she sounded a little irascible when she said, "What?" "I think we are talking over each other," said the fifth adept, rubbing her mittened hands together. "I'm not asking about the preserved soul that made you a lictor, Reverend Daughter, though that's also filled in some of the pieces. Haro Hark, I am referring to the invasive soul." "The invasive?" "You are being haunted," said Abigail calmly. "I had assumed you had picked this battlefield deliberately and raised an army to fight alongside you. I didn't quite know why you'd chosen us. Now I know, but it seems you did not. You are possessed by an angry spirit, Haro, and you are losing the war." Haro reflexively tried to pad out her fat reserves. It was really shockingly cold. She was stopped when she realized she could not identify where they sat under the skin of her arms, let alone augment them. The limitation was familiar. It was the limitation she had lived with all her life, when she was ninth and not first. Her furnace of power was gone. She reached for the memory of her other self. No. She underserved herself by separating herself into two halves. Haro first, and Haro secondarius, as though she were following bells. They were all one Harrowhark wearing different clothes, and she was no better now that her vestments were black. In a way, she was greatly worse. But the memory was there. Think of how when you blow air into water, you make bubbles. It was getting chillier. The wind howled against the darkened window. There was no good weather in her brain. She said, "We are in the river." "Yes," said Abigail. "That was my first realization." "This is my creation." "Yes, you set the parameters," said Abigail. "We realized through process of elimination, as we each recalled ourselves in the end. You didn't. Ortus was convinced it was your creation from the start. I'm sorry that I disbelieved him." That was for later mental delectation. "I made a bubble in the river, just like Sextus did, but unconsciously, shoddily." Sextus must have thought her such a churl. It would have been an enormous relief to have Palamedes Sextus with her then, if only so that she could perhaps offer some paltry thanks. But to have him see her so slow on the uptake would be hideous. "Why Canaan House? Why Ortus Nigenad?" "To fill the hole in my memory." Thankfully, Pent was quicker on the uptake. "You didn't remove the memories of your cavalier, Haro Hark. I think that would have been beyond even the powers of a lictor. You falsified them. You skinned them over with something that looked good. What a waste of a woman to have ended her life at the bottom of a ladder." "But why make so many changes? Why is this narrative so different? This isn't how it happened at all. I understand that Gideon had to be absent, but why—" "This isn't a picture you're drawing, Haro," said Pent. "It's a play you're directing. You set up a stage in the river. You pulled in ghosts as your actors, and you enforced certain rules to keep your cast on script. But now another director is trying to hijack the play, and the struggle for control backstage is leaking over into the action out front. You're being ousted."
"By whom?"
"I don't know," said Abigail candidly, "and there are other discrepancies I'd hoped you could have shed light on. Why did you only pull some of us as ghosts? Why did the others appear as varyingly ludicrous constructs? Lieutenant Dias was certain Judith was wrong before she even died, that she was like a confused parody of herself. I never could have called the ghost of Captain Deuteros, interrupted Harrow. Deuteros lives. Abigail leaned in eagerly. Tell Dias that. She'll want to know. The princesses? Alive. Their cavalier? Breakfast. At Abigail's bewilderment, Harrow qualified. Ianthe Tridentarius is a lictor. Blast! It should have been Coronabeth. Ianthe never was quite the thing. The sixth? Camilla's alive. Palamedes enjoys extenuating circumstances. At this second round of bewilderment, she qualified. The Master Warden found the idea of dying inconvenient. Abigail brightened. Say no more. The fifth house necromancer sighed in obvious pleasure, a simple delight that some of them had lived where she herself had not. A deep guilt sparked within Harrow's ribcage. Pent even murmured, "The king over the river is good," which filled Harrow with another sensation entirely. That brought with it a reminder so savagely stupid she was astonished that it had not been her first thought. Her hands flew to her midsection. She closed her eyes. She leant back into the soft curve of her spine. She took the reins of the river in her hands, and she walked out into the waters, and she walked, and she walked. As her cavalier might have put it, absolutely butt-fuck nothing happened. She could not access the river. She was not aware of it. There was no awareness of the anchor of her body. Just as with the removal of her literal magic, there was no exit route. She was trapped within the bubble, writhing like a fish, and somewhere, back on the Mithraeum.
Time, said Harrow urgently.
How does this track with time?
Based on my assumptions about spirit magic and the nature of consciousness, said Abigail, this stage only exists when you have limited or no conscious awareness. While you sleep, or while you have been knocked out, or otherwise disconnected from outside stimuli. I have not experienced any breaks in time. It's seamless from this side. I imagine the simulation runs within your sleeping mind's understanding of time, if somewhat contracted and dilated. How much time has passed in the real world?
9 months.
Good Lord! She was genuinely upset. I would have put us at about 8 weeks. Oh, my family's probably been told. They'll be wondering where the living hell my spirit is. My poor brother, Magnus's parents, my fern collection.
Lady Pent, said Harrow Hark forcefully, forget the ferns. In the real world, I have been fatally stabbed. The place that holds my body is about to be overrun by thanagetic monsters created by a galactic revenant. I am, put bluntly, on the verge of death. My soul is under siege, and I overwrote my real memories with a ghost-filled pocket dimension, which has now apparently been co-opted by some kind of poltergeist. From what I can tell, I am stuck in here. I cannot get out, and I am about to die. I may even be dead already, which will render this all somewhat moot. The window cracked. At first she assumed it was the howling, killing wind, but as she and Abigail watched, a questing pink tentacle, crackling with ice as it shifted and slithered, made a ropey trail down a broken hole in the glass, a long, pulsing tube. As they watched, a sphincter opened in the end, and from that hole emerged a clattering pile of plex scope slides, the type you would preserve a cell sample between. The door to the bedroom had been flung open. The previously dead Magnus Quinn was there, wearing a huge furry coat, cavern-cheeked from the chill, saying, "They're breaching the walls, dear."
"Tell Protesilaus and the Lieutenant not to touch them."
"Too late, and I can't blame them. These things are vile."
"Leave your body to your body, Reverend Daughter," said Abigail, rising shakily to stand, her teeth chattering. If you were dead on the other side, we'd all be gone by now. If you die in here, your soul is gone forever. Right now, in this moment, you are alive. Let us ensure that if your body survives, you will remain at the helm. Harrow fought to be heard over the screams of the wind. But I was stabbed through the stomach. What's happening out there?